Welcome to the podcast that's dedicated to making you a faster cyclist, the Ask a Cycling Coach podcast presented by Trainer Road. I'm Coach Jonathan Lee, and joining me today is Coach Chad Timmerman.
Hello.
And Nate Pearson, CEO of Trainer Road.
Hello.
And this is where you get answers to your coaching questions, whether they're triathlon, cycling related, whatever it may be. You can submit your questions to us at support@trainerroad.com, and we'll throw them into the list and hopefully get to the question that you've submitted. We'll get to as many as we can every week. You can find this podcast on SoundCloud, on iTunes, and now on Stitcher as well. Just search for Ask a Cycling Coach or Trainer Road, and it should pop right up. And leave us a review, a five-star review. Those have been pouring in, so thanks for those. Leave us a five-star review if you feel so inclined, and let us know what you think of it. We'll start things off this week with Toby's question. Hello, Trainer Road. I train 8 to 10 hours a week at present during the winter. My day job consists of me sitting down for 5 to 6 hours a day, so not uncommon for a lot of us. How detrimental is this to my progression in training, and what can I do to minimize the effects that sitting down for long periods has on my body?
So, Toby, I think the biggest concern here, or the two biggest, are probably your recovery, in which case sitting is probably the better option in comparison to standing, and then flexibility issues. Riding a bike puts your hips, your hip flexors specifically, in a shortened position, and being seated does nothing to help that issue. So in terms of minimizing the flexibility issues, just get up from time to time. If you know how to stretch your hip flexors or your quads, that's another option. But as far as this being detrimental to your training, I don't really see that being an issue.
There's an interesting article recently that said that before somebody put out something that said if you stand, the more you stand, the longer you're going to live and the better health you're going to have. But there was also a recent article that just came out, I think maybe last week, mm-hmm. that said for those that are actively working out, that standing won't increase your lifespan any more than if you only just worked out.
So that makes sense too.
Yeah, because we think that, so at Trainer Road, everyone has these really cool stand-up desks, and they have like four different pre-programmed heights. We got them from Ergo Depot, and they're the Jarvis standing desks, and we really like them. They're kind of expensive though. They go up to about $800. And so we use them, but the more I train, I'm like Chad, I want recovery. So if I'm not training, I'll be sitting in my chair, put my feet up. I might even sit in a recliner. Another thing that I do in the office is if I'm not training to get up is, and most offices can't do this, but we actually have weights and like a pull-up bar and that kind of stuff. Just getting up and doing that, or getting up and getting coffee, can kind of help it so that your hip flexors don't get too tight. And you can also kind of get the blood circulating. You can also get a really cheap, so if you're not training too hard for other people, so not for Toby, but if you're not training too hard, you can just get something, a really small stand-up desk, and maybe put a laptop on and work on that an hour a day or so. I know, Jonathan, you use a stand-up desk all the time, don't you?
Yeah, I stand a lot, and this is the main issue. Like you guys have pointed out something that's really important, and there's an old maxim that goes with this, you know, if you're standing, sit. If you're sitting, lay down type of a deal. You should always be looking to maximize your ability to recover and reduce the stress on your body. But for me, if I'm sitting after I work out, or if I spend an extended amount of time sitting, I have a lot of problems with tightness in my hips, and especially, like Chad pointed out, the hip flexors. And that causes knee issues. It causes a whole host of issues. So this is something that I stand quite a lot, and I know that it's a compromise, because while I may be avoiding, hopefully, some issues that I would have with tightening in my hips after I do a workout and after, because I work out every morning, even though I may be avoiding those issues, I am not getting as good of recovery. So I kind of have to measure that out and weigh the options. If I can, I'll lay down on a, we have a couch in the office where we're at, so I could lay down and work out or and work from there. But yeah, it's just kind of a compromise. For those of you with tight hips or knee issues, or if you know that that's your type of situation, then just take that into account. Standing can at least put you in a position where you're lengthening those muscles. So as they're recovering and just as you're spending more time there, that can help with that. But I think most of us are active enough that we don't really yield. A lot of those things are kind of people that are talking about ramping up their steps with a pedometer type of a person, you know, and most people that are listening to this podcast are talking about structured training and getting faster. So it's kind of a different bracket than a lot of the stand-up desk articles you see out there. So you guys have anything else to add to that?
I don't.
Nope.
Cool. Then we'll move on to Kevin's question. Kevin asks, what do I gain by trying to increase the precision metric for each interval? Oftentimes, I find that my average power for an interval is close to the target power, but my precision is very low. Looking at the same interval in Training Peaks shows a variable index of 1 or 1.01. Is the overall average of the, for the interval the most important, or is precision informing on something that I'm not aware of?
Yeah, so this is a good point and a good question a lot of people have. So precision is something that actually I made up, and the idea being that, let's say you have a 20-minute interval, and during that, you could have your average power be exactly the same, but you might not really be nailing it. You could, you know, you kind of like taper off while you don't pay attention, and then you go really hard to kind of try to get your average power back up, and then it kind of goes on both sides of it, and your workout starts to change to be kind of over-unders rather than just nailing the threshold that we were that we prescribed to you. So what precision does is it says every second that you go by, if you're plus or minus within 10 watts of your target, then you get a point for that one. If you miss it, you lose a point. So at the end, we can have a, what we do is we can say what percentage of like the points did you hit? So if you hit 100%, you were always like really close to your target and you did a great job. This one is going to be really specific to the type of power meter you have, because you have a kicker that kind of artificially smooths the data, plus it locks you in. You're going to be at like 99% precision all the time. If you had a quark, you know, and you hit like 30%, it could be really good because a quark jumps around a lot more. But the idea behind it is just to really focus on your intervals and try to just nail them just the way it is. Because as you guys know, if you ever turn down the intensity, just like a 5% difference can mean all the difference in the world about how you're training, how your recovery is, the amount of stress that we're putting on your body. And variability index too is, it's still going to be pretty close. And for those who don't know, the variability index is it's the difference between normalized power and average power, and it kind of tells you how spiky you're going to be. The precision is much more sensitive than compared to the variability index. So it's what I strive for is, if I'm not using a kicker, is just to always try to increase that number, and it's based on your power meter. So you'll get used to it and you'll say, okay, I'm probably always at 40, and if you do an interval down to 20, you know you did something bad and you should pay more attention.
Chad, do you have anything to add to that too?
No.
As far as,
no, I don't.
I mean, you're prescribing these workouts, right? I mean, you're the one that's writing down these intervals and you're structuring the whole thing.
Yeah, Nate basically covered it. I mean, average power can be a little misleading. So that the precision metric is helpful on top of the average power.
Here's a question, Chad. So if someone does, like, let's say they have a 10-minute interval, for the first 5 minutes they find they're 10 watts below. Mm-hmm. Should for the final 5 minutes they do the interval at 10 watts over, so that their average is the same, or should they just move forward with, you know, what is prescribed?
Yeah, ideally follow what's prescribed. So if you're a little low, you're not trying to compensate and bring that average up. It's not all about the average, it's about precision. So the precision in this case is actually more important than the average power.
Yeah, you're talking about adaptations that you want to bring about with a set power figure, right, for that interval.
Exactly.
And I know, Nate, we've talked about this because we get the suggestion a lot of the time to have like an average power number,
yes,
shown, mm-hmm, on our app. And we haven't done that really for this reason, because we don't want people chasing an average. We want them to be sticking to the target, regardless of where they were prior during the interval.
You know? That's exactly right. So other apps too, they'll show like, you know, all the data in the world. And there's a reason why we only show four fields while you're working out, besides the time. One, because your IQ goes a lot lower while you're working out. But in the moment, all we want to do is have you hit the target power for that second. Don't be worried about the next power coming up or what you did in the past or what your average for the interval is. Worry about that second and nail that second. Be in that moment and go through your entire workout and be in the moment of the workout and do what we say. And if you messed up the previous one, that's a fine. Just get the next second right and then get the next second after that.
And having said that, we still don't completely ignore, or as far as, we still do visually show the average, right, Nate? That's in that little bar that you see. It's the ball that moves.
So if that ball is right on top of the target power line, then your interval average is the same. And we use that ball on purpose because it's less accurate than a number. So if someone is, so you can get like a little visual cue that you are low, but there's no reason to then try to like overdo it. So the ball is just perfectly lined up, and it is a fuzzy metric. People go, well, I can't tell exactly to the watt where I'm at. And we do that on purpose. It's it's designed to be fuzzy, just to kind of give you a overall feeling of where you're at.
Yeah, we want the precision to be based on, like we've said, the here and now. So, good question. We would like that. Thanks, Kevin, for sending it in. Sean, hi. Sent this question through support, and I didn't hear back. Sorry. We try to get to as many as we can. Sometimes we don't get to them all. So, in fact, actually, every time we can't get to them all. We get a lot of questions. However, he starts off with this. First, love the podcast and 5 stars. Thanks, man. Appreciate it. Question, I have a local bike shop and gym that offers lactate threshold testing. The coach there is telling me that it is a far, and he says far in all caps, better metric to use for power training and racing than your FTP. Is this true? And if so, why? And he follows up by saying, then if I do get the testing, do I replace my FTP number in your training plans or lactate threshold? This is a common runaround, a good question too, Chad. What do you think?
Yeah, so I don't know that it's necessarily a better metric. It's going to be a little more personalized, and it's also more invasive, though. So it's not as convenient. This is changing because there are devices that are emerging that allow you to measure blood lactate. How good they are, I don't know. I haven't gotten a chance to play with one, and I haven't done a whole lot of reading on them. But this might be something that's changing, so it might be an alternative metric, but I don't know that it's necessarily better than FTP. And then if you're just getting it tested occasionally and associating a power number with it, it's important to understand that your lactate curve or your lactate profile can shift as your training changes your physiological responses. So as your conditioning improves, that curve can shift. So if you're using numbers that were based on where your curve was at one point and you're not updating your FTP based on performance, but instead that lactate figure, you have to continually, the point of this is it's not very convenient. And I'm not entirely sure it's better, even if it were convenient.
Yeah, and two, the FTP is supposed to be corollary to lactic threshold. That's
another thing.
For. Yeah, so yeah. It's supposed to be really close. And it might not be super close in general, but it's kind of been proven through just the amount of, through science and for the amount of people that have done it, is that if you generate the way your FTP through what Andrew Coggan has you generate your FTP, which is some of the ways that we say too. You're going to improve if you follow the zones off of that. And I bet you the guy who owns, we sell a product too, but who owns the bike shop and gym, who's offering the threshold testing, it's
yes.
probably
it's a bit biased.
Yeah. I mean, if it's free and he's like, you have to do this and you want to go in and do it every 6 weeks, that's cool. But if he's charging a lot of money, there's someone else I know who does that. It's like, you need to know your VO2 max. You have such a, like, if you know your VO2 max, it's really going to improve your training and racing. Doesn't tell you anything. It's like a number.
Yeah, that's the hard thing. Like, so here's the deal. How are you going to be measuring your lactate threshold while you're on the bike? Like Chad said, there are devices coming out that do that. But then again, where's the training structure based all around that? And power, ideally, as you get more familiar with assessing your FTP, assessing your lactate threshold in terms of power, in other words, you should be doing a better job every time you test. If you're improving with that, you should be doing a better job of getting an accurate indication of your lactate threshold. And you're just representing it in terms of power, right? So, and the convenient thing about that is that we can have power meters on our bike, and now they're for even lower cost. They're constantly dropping in price. So you can actually, you really can use that metric to adjust how you train and race, right? But just off of your lactate threshold number, and this is very similar to VO2 max, like Nate said, if you don't have an accurate indication of lactate buildup and processing going on in your body while you're riding, then you can't do much with that. In fact, you can't do anything with it.
Yeah, I think what I would do, so let's say, because I would be very interested to find out what my lactic threshold is with actual blood work. Let's say I do it and my FTP comes out as 300 and my blood lactic threshold comes out as 320, right? And then I go, okay, so now I'm going to set my FTP at 320 and I'm going to do train road workouts. Well, they're not going to probably be doable because the FTP is lower. Let's say I do the opposite. My lactic threshold comes out as 270. So I start doing all the train road workouts at 270. They're not going to be hard enough based on what my actual power output was during that for my FTP to really get the fitness gains. So if you do go this way, you might need to do like the entire system this guy is saying.
Yeah, on top of that, there's the test protocol is a of particular concern. They have, it's a step test, right? So it gets harder every, you know, maybe 3 minutes, they nudge it up 20 watts. Well, 20 watts is a big jump. So if you're holding steady at say 300 watts, and then they nudge you up to 320 watts, and boom, your lactate skyrockets. Yep. Okay, your threshold's what? Where within that 300 to 320 range? Because that's a big range.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
And that goes with it's super common to get the situation that you said, Nate, and partly perhaps because of the testing protocol, but it's very common to see people test, if they get lactate threshold testing compared to even people that are very experienced. I know, Chad, you even had an experience with this, but mm-hmm. people that are very experienced and know how to assess their FTP effectively, they still, it's common to see them get a different number for their lactate threshold during the test. And whether that's because there's a psychological limiter or something else that's taking place when they're actually taking their FTP test, or whether that's just a flaw in the testing protocol. There's a number of different variables, but the whole goal behind having a structured training system is to reduce variables and have objective data. So
that's huge. Like, try doing over-unders of your threshold. So if anyone's ever done over-unders, those are, to me, one of the hardest workouts for me to do. And if you just change it by 5 watts, it can be turned into an impossible workout. Or yep. if you change the other ways, it's an easy workout. 5 watts, right? It's crazy.
Right. So, Sean, hopefully that gives you an idea. And once again, we don't want to completely discourage lactate threshold testing because we...
Yeah, hey, Sean, here's one thing you can do is do both. You know, get a lactate threshold test, see where it pins your FTP, and then apply that. You know, maybe try a couple workouts and see if that seems to be close. I mean, there's no reason you can't do the two of them and compare them. But as far as convenience, FTP is going to be a lot more convenient.
And just remember that you want to have something that you can measure when you're riding and racing, right? So that's an important mm-hmm. thing that you have, and make sure that's reliable. So, Kevin, when I do the individual leg drills portion of the workouts like Goddard, that's one of our workouts, I find that my right leg fatigues very quickly to the point that I have difficulty bringing the foot over the top of the pedal stroke. In particular, from about the 10 o'clock to 1 o'clock position, I end up relying on momentum to carry the foot over the top. And when I do force myself to actually move the foot through that part of the pedal stroke, my right knee tends to track outward. None of this occurs on my left leg, where I can maintain chain tension all the way around the pedal stroke. So any suggestions on what might be causing it and how to address it? Thanks, and keep up the great podcast.
Yeah, Kevin, this is exactly why we do independent leg drills. Not necessarily to strengthen the leg in different ranges, although that is a benefit. In this case, the top quadrant of your pedal stroke, where you're largely hip flexor driven, for whatever reason, there's an imbalance between your right and left leg. So and it's one of the upshots of doing individual leg exercises. So in this case, basically, you're just going to have to kind of nurture that weaker leg, and that probably means shorter bouts of ILT. So maybe you can, you know, tolerate a minute on the stronger leg, and only 20 seconds on the right leg. There's I don't advise you to just gut it out and to let your knee start tracking outward and start to reinforce these faulty recruitment patterns and these bad habits, basically. So when you start to fade, that just means that leg's cooked for now. Switch to the other leg. Even if that means, you know, your time's going to be imbalanced between the two legs, so maybe stay both feet clipped in for a little while. Over time, just try to extend the durations that your weaker leg can effectively kick across that top weak quadrant.
If could another option just be to downshift and have a little bit less power on
that
leg?
Absolutely. So reduce the resistance a little bit, make it a little bit easier for that leg, and you can accumulate longer durations in that manner also.
This is a side note, but I just did Goddard 2 days ago, and no kidding. I took a little bit of time off and focused on some weightlifting, but I'm getting back into cycling to hit next season really hard. And my heart rate got up to, John, you haven't heard this, 196. 196 on the trainer. I had the Wahoo. It was accurate, the Wahoo ticker.
That would kill
on
me.
And what percentage of FTP were you at, roughly?
Oh, I had to turn down the workout. I don't do what I did. I came back and I was like, oh, my FTP is probably like, I don't know what it was, but it had gone down a lot less than that. I didn't want to,
that hurts the pride.
That's a lesson for everybody right there. Don't assume your FTP is where you left it, because it's not.
Exactly. I should have just done a test, and I need to do a test probably, maybe even today I might do a test.
You know, the one thing that I said that I would say with this too, with individual leg drills, just something that's helped me. I've been doing a lot of work on my flexibility as of late, and really focusing, as I mentioned earlier in this podcast, I have issues with tight hip flexors. And being able to actually stretch those out has allowed me to function much more effectively in the pedal stroke. And I've noticed that I'm able to perform those drills much better. And I do believe that the stretching has helped. Not just the fact that I've been doing individual leg drills for a while because I'm in the middle of sweet spot bass, but I really do feel that that's helped me out. Just check out the imbalances you may have. Clearly there is an imbalance and perhaps a strength imbalance and a flexibility imbalance. And it's something that you can take a look at. It certainly couldn't help to spend some time to focus on flexibility there. So, it's something that comes with time, and it's you're not the only one. In fact, I even asked Dave Christensen. He's our filmmaker. He's an absolute beast on the bike. He races UCI races all over the place. And he read your question. He said, "Yep, I had the same thing last night." So you're not alone, Kevin. We're all in the same boat. So, Paul, I've used Trainer Road to supplement my triathlon training for a couple of years, but want to adopt a structured training approach for 2016. I've reviewed the plans and intend to do sweet spot base, a sustained power build, and then a specialty triathlon plan. However, how should I add run and swim workouts to the plans, and how should I plan the intensity of these sessions using a heart rate monitor? This is, Paul, you're like a pitch man for an ad for us right now.
Yeah, so Paul, we just released the triathlon base plans today. So if you check the training plans page, you'll see a whole new slew of plans, either for sprint, Olympic, half distance, or full distance, and there's three volume options per each of those. So that's our first step into making the triathlon end of things much more complete. The workouts are all RPE based, so perceived exertion based, but there's no reason you can't associate heart rates with those if you want to train by heart rate, both in the typically people in the pool train by time, but yeah. As far as running, if you want to use heart rate, you can absolutely do that. But the perceived exertion descriptions are, I think, a pretty solid way to go.
I don't want to diverge too much here, but I just want to back up the RPE side of things there. If I don't have a power meter, I seem to rely on RPE more than heart rate. It tends to give me a reliable workout. You know, mm-hmm. I try to take into account the fact that RPE does change, or at least my power output at RPE does change over time. But
yeah,
it's a solid way to do it.
For swimming, I use 100% the my 100 time, and I kind of know where my 100 times are for different distances, and I try to hit those and improve those, and that's a pretty good correlation to power, except for unless your drag changes as you're swimming, which it will, but it's pretty much as good as we have right now in swimming. And then for running, I really like just using pace, so I have a Garmin. It depends on where I live. Now I live in an area where it's kind of more flat land, and if I'm running on flats, I can totally use pace. Before I had it where it was more undulating terrain, and that heart rate would have been good, but I always get hurt running on downhill. So I really just don't do that anymore and only run flats. I only run downhills and races.
And Paul, I should also add these triathlon base plans are very sweet spot in nature. And then I am right now working on the build portion of these. So ideally, these new tri base plans will fold into tri build plans, which will fold into the existing specialty triathlon plans, which I'll also be adding swim and run workouts to.
David has a number of questions, guys. We're going to run through kind of his season, but to be honest, I think that his season doesn't vary a whole lot from what a lot of you guys are doing in one respect for another. So we'll try to isolate the principles and the context and then just explain it all to you. So he mentions that he's been using Trainer Road for 12 months and followed a traditional base, sustained build, and a mixture of criterium and rolling road race plans. That's a common mix that we see last season, and it worked for me jumping up a classification. So kudos on that. Good job, David. So once again, this year, my very first priority race or a race is the Gran Fondo New York, where you qualified for the Front Corral. So kudos on that too. Prior to the Gran Fondo New York, I have some rolling road races and probably some crits. I'm not looking to peak for these races, but just stay with the pack. So that's good too. You're already prioritizing your races. So that's good. All right. So now we'll get into the meat and potatoes. I've started the high volume traditional base plan and have built in enough time to complete a build and specialty plans, with the peak week being Gran Fondo New York. However, I'm a little uncertain which way to go after the base period. As it stands, I've settled on the high volume sustained power build and have included a long hilly ride on Saturday and Sunday, gradually increasing the ride time and intensity to replicate the Gran Fondo New York. So before we go any further, Chad, that's a common thing to see, right? For a lot of riders to have follow a structured, shorter workouts during the week and then weekends do something longer.
Yeah, I think it's an ideal blend. If you have the good fortune of being able to ride outside and increase the duration of that ride, especially when you're on track for something like a Gran Fondo, I think it's not really a better way to go.
And then he follows up with, I've come to the conclusion that I need the sustained power build for the climbs and racing of the Gran Fondo New York, but also need to stress my body in preparation for the 4.5 hours of the Gran Fondo New York will take me. So this weekend ride should help with that. But there's one point that I wanted to bring out here. You've mentioned that you feel like you need the sustained power build for the longer climbs. And that's something that's an astute observation. And I see actually a lot of people think that they need to do rolling road race when, because of the fact that their race is going to have rolling hills and or just a lot of climbing, but they're not that long. That sustained power build is great for people that are going to be on sustained climbs, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And the rolling road race, those are punchy climbs. I mean, all hills roll, right? They eventually all come down. So it's just a question of how long are you going to be climbing and how aggressively, you know, how high intensity are those climbs. So that's the differentiator between the climbing and the rolling road race. Rolling road race, hard punchy climbs where you're really on the gas and then you're on a downhill and then you have to do it again. Whereas with the sustained nature of the climbing road race, those are like uphill time trials, you know, where you settle in at a sustainable level of your FTP and you're there for a while. And then you probably don't have to do that again too often over the course of the race.
Now, after the Gran Fondo New York, he's going to have a week of holiday. So he's going to be relaxing, taking time off, and then he's going to return to the UK for 2 weeks. And that's 2 weeks prior to him heading to a training camp. And it's going to be a rough training camp, 80 to 100 miles of riding per day with 10,000 feet of climbing each day. So Chad, he'll run through a whole base build specialty up until a goal event. That's common for a lot of our users. And then he has a couple weeks. He has a week off, and then he has 2 weeks for something for him to prepare for, not necessarily an A race, but just to be able to sustain a lot of volume. What would you suggest they do, or he does here?
I'd focus on little more than recovery. So that 1 week sounds like it'll be devoted entirely to recovery. And then those 2 weeks afterward, probably something low-key, like one of the traditional base, probably the low volume. It doesn't matter how much you ride, but keep the intensity low. You're going into something that's going to be very demanding, so carrying fatigue into it is only going to work against you.
That's a good point, right? Because a lot of the time we feel like there's a big training camp coming up or a big event coming up or something with big volume. So we need to adapt our fitness and we only have a few weeks. It's not going to happen that quickly. You know, it's pretty tough to do. You'll only get more tired. And now finally, to close out his question, he says, on return from the Alps, I will be competing in a rolling road race, crits, time trials, probably 2 races every week through the season. And I was thinking of moving on to the Criterium specialty plan for this period. That seems like a good plan, Chad. His concern, though, is he going to be tiring himself out with a long season like that? Or what are your thoughts?
That's for him to determine. I mean, everything looks good. Any one of those training plans is going to suffice since you're pretty varied in the sort of racing you're doing. But I think it looks pretty good.
Yeah, in general, too, since if you look at it, so he's going, you know, starting with traditional base, high volume, because he can take it. And then he's doing like an FTP build and focusing on that. And then the crit plan is a lot of VO2 max and anaerobic. So he's going to have like, he's going to hit all the systems throughout the year at different parts. And since he's going to have too a mix of everything, I think it's a really good approach. It's just the, it sounds like this guy can take a ton of,
it does. Yep.
Or David can take a ton of, stress. Even just doing the high volume traditional base, that in itself, like, is really hard to do, and have enough, you know, have the recovery for that. So kudos to you, David, if you can do it. But I think it sounds outstanding and I hope you do really well. Let us know how you do.
Yeah. And I want to go to that Alps training camp. That sounds like a blast.
So do I.
Yeah. That'd be great. Brent, he just shares some information with us and I feel like it's really valuable. I think 2 podcasts ago, remember the guy that we talked about who was questioning why prioritize your races to have an A race?
He wants to win every race. Why would you?
Exactly. Yeah. Why wouldn't you want to win every race, right? Yeah. So Brent shares what he does and how he prioritizes, and I thought it was really good. We actually have a blog post that just went up about this on our website, and I feel like Brent kind of adds some context to the principles we talked about.
blog.trainerroad.com.
Yes, you can find it on there. here's what he is talking about. He says, with road racers like me, it can be difficult to decide what an A race is because we are often racing every weekend, sometimes twice per weekend, from April through August. And I know this is really true for a lot of masters racers, right? You're doing masters racing and you're doing elite racing, and you may be doing two crits on a weekend, something like that. So yeah, you do a lot of stuff and you'll be doing that for a whole year. In my case, I focused on two weekends, 8 weeks apart. So see what he did there? I like that. How, sure, he's going to be racing a long time, but he picked two races. And if the races aren't of particular value or outstanding value one to another, it's up to you to pick. Just pick your peaks and then try to, you know, prepare yourself for those races. In my case, I focused on two weekends, 8 weeks apart, which included a popular three-day stage race and a state championship road race. Events leading up to those were typically my B races, with my C races very early in the season. I race on a team, and among teammates, we discuss who is going to focus on which races throughout the season. We'll have different strategies depending on our role in each race. If we are racing a B or a C race, our focus is not on winning the race, but on helping our teammate who is racing get their A race win, either by sheltering them, chasing down breakaways, blocking other teams, etc. So no, we're not necessarily out there to win ourselves, but to help the team win. Obviously, this would change if the person is racing unattached, but from a team perspective, there is a definite advantage to A, B, and C races, and I'd argue for even individuals too.
Yeah, a cool thing about that too is when you're helping somebody else, and the race is tougher, right? Like when you want to win a race, what you do is you pretty much don't work out for, you know, if it's a two-hour race, you try not to work out for 1 hour and 59 minutes of it, and then just put it all out in 1 minute. Which isn't really going to raise your TSS. But if you're sheltering someone, you could get a real, you know, you're doing a lot of work for 2 hours of chasing down breaks and stuff. So it's a, I love this, what Brent said and sent to us.
Yeah, that's good stuff, Brent.
Yeah, and Chad, you've got a lot of experience with that too. And you actually were the one that kind of taught me through experience with this. So
yeah, it's really enjoyable having different roles at different times, especially if your fitness isn't exactly there. And then when your fitness is there, you're particularly motivated and probably have racked up some goodwill from your teammates such that they're now supporting you, and you get to not only exploit your high-end fitness, but you get to utilize, you know, their assistance. So it's a fun way to alter the goals and outcomes, or just the way you spend each race.
And if you don't have a team, I'd still suggest following the same tactic. And to be honest, it's pretty rare that you find a team that won't accept help if you offer it. You know, yeah,
you might be on that team soon.
Exactly. If you're offering it and you're not a bonehead on the course, then you could very well find yourself in a situation where you'll actually understand this, have opportunities to build more fitness than you would otherwise, and you'll reach a peak that's much closer to the actual physiological peak. You know,
yeah. I did that too when I was at when I first got into cycling and I was at a lower level. And at the lower levels, you're much less likely to find guys on teams. You get some people that are buddies. You're like, hey, let's all race for and work for this guy today. Mm-hmm. And it's just fun. And everyone's fun. And you're like, you have a beer afterwards and you talk about your epic ride, and it's cool.
Yeah, exactly. Aaron, I have an upcoming trip that will take me away from my bike and trainer for over a month. While I'd love to take them with me, I can't afford the cost and hassle. I should have access to both exercise and spin bikes, as well as mountain bike rentals. I'm a mountain biker. Don't you dare touch a spin bike if you have a mountain bike at your disposal. Come on. I'd love to continue my training with Trainer Road while on this trip, as I've noticed a difference with your programs already. And you mentioned that you're in week 5 of Sweet Spot Base 1, so good job. I will likely be finishing Sweet Spot Base 2 around the time of your trip, I'm assuming, and starting your build. I'm a short-distance triathlete with your very first A race in May. So, the question, do you have any recommendations on how I can still follow the plans, either using a spin bike or a rented mountain bike? Thank you.
Yeah, so I'm assuming you don't have any method to measure power, so you're going to have to work on, I'd recommend, perceived exertion. And with Sweet Spot Base 1 and 2 in under your belt, you're going to have a good basis for you know, what particular power outputs feel like. And then, you know, with the mobile app or the computer, whatever, you'll still see the structure of the workout and just follow that based on perceived exertion. You'll know at that point what a hard 2 minute VO2 max effort feels like versus a 12 minute sweet spot effort. So just train by RPE.
And if I were you, I would do some of those workouts on the spin bike. Not exercise bikes are weird. Spin bike has more inertia. It's more like a real road bike. And then I would also do the mountain bike. and ride those maybe when you have a little bit more time on the weekends. And then you can do Xterras because you're a triathlete. You have the mountain bike skills. Opens your whole season up to more racing. It'll be awesome.
Yeah. And I would recommend as far as mountain biking, because it can be really tough to get in structured workouts on a mountain bike. I mean, we talk about stoplights and other interruptions on the road, but on the trail, really a lot of your pace is depicted by the terrain that you're riding over. So it can be difficult. I would recommend on the mountain, even though I want to say ride a mountain bike every day, all day, but I would recommend using the mountain bike if you have something in specific to do, where you may not actually be doing anything that's going to be requiring a lot of structure. That can, just because of the fact that it's difficult to add that structure at times on the mountain bike, especially, and I'm just assuming this, so this may not be the case, Aaron, but since you're traveling, it's probably going to be unfamiliar terrain too. So if that's the case, it can be difficult to lay out exactly what you'll do on the road. So, Sean, he's got a question here about power zones. After 10 plus years of cycling, I've finally been introduced to specific or specified training through your podcast and Train a Road program app. Thanks so much. And so much is in five caps, all a lot of exclamation points, five stars. Good stuff. Good to have you, Sean. I completed my FTP test and I'm setting up my power zones based on the chart in your help center. So you said, I just want to make sure I got this correct and the chart, these are the charts or zones that I should be using. Chad, do you have, first of all, he got an FTP of 231 and he's laying out his power zones here off of that.
So that auto calculates. I mean, that all of your zones are automatically updated and your workouts are scaled to your FTP. So you really don't have to do that. You might use that information when you're not using Trainer Road, when you're training outdoors. But as far as everything that you're going to do within Trainer Road, that's handled for you.
And just another question we get pretty commonly is what power zones we use. Because depending on like what philosophy you follow, there's different power zones. And we follow Dr. Andrew Coggan and his power zones. Now, one thing that throws some people off is that, in his power zones, he doesn't have a sweet spot necessarily in his power zones. He has this huge tempo and then no sweet spot defined. But then in other places, all he does is talk about sweet spot. And he says it's this zone between three and four, which is tempo and threshold. So what we did is we, inside of that spot, we picked a range that we felt was indicative of sweet spot and then defined it. Because what we didn't want to do was say you're in tempo and also sweet spot, or you're also in threshold and sweet spot, just to make it really well-defined. And it works great. We still base the overall, when Chad does workouts, I mean, he's a student of all the power scientists, but when he does them and prescribes them based on books that he read, he just does them by percent FTP. And the sweet spot recording that we do is more for like measuring and metrics after the fact. So I don't know if that's too clear.
Yeah, go ahead. And Hunter Allen defines it, I think, as 88 to 94. So we just broaden that range a little bit, but all these are overlapping zones anyway. So there's not a clear point where you're not doing tempo anymore and now you are doing sweet spot and now you're doing threshold. It all overlaps. So we went a little wider with that range because frankly, the effects trickle out wider than a tight 6 watt range or 6% range.
That's what Coggan says a ton too, is that if we define threshold up to 105, when you hit 106, it's like, okay, I'm completely out of threshold and I'm completely in VO2 max. It doesn't. They all bleed together. And it's your body doesn't know the exact percentage. So it's
a continuum.
It's this big curve where you're hitting.
It's like
stuff.
It's like those fader lights from houses that were built back in the 60s or 70s, right? Like you've got like a bunch of faders and those things are constantly adjusting in intensity. It's not like you're hitting light switches. So that's something to be honest, a lot of us kind of think that there is a defined point when we're talking about your lactate threshold, right? Where your body isn't able to reprocess as much lactate as it's producing. There's about as close as we get to a defined line, but just the same, we're still talking about, there's fuzziness in this stuff. So to a certain degree. And the next question, I've been listening to all of your podcasts and doing a bunch of research, and this is still Sean's question. So it seems like 10 plus years of cycling, I've spent most of my time riding in the tempo or gray zone. And he's sad about that, he says.
Like four sad faces. I'm sad for you, Tim.
So my question is, when I'm on an outdoor ride or riding on the trails, should I be avoiding the tempo or gray zone at all costs, like either ride in recovery and endurance or bump up the effort to sweet spot or above? just never let myself fall into that tempo zone, which ironically always seems to be my pace and the pace of the people I ride with.
It's because it's comfortable. It's fast but comfortable.
There's nothing wrong with the tempo zone. It's just if you spend all your time there, you're never going to get faster. It doesn't bring about results. The fact of the matter is, you do a 5-hour road race, you're going to spend most of your time there, maybe even a little below it. So it's absolutely usable and used, but it's not very productive. So it's a little too hard to be considered recovery, and it's not hard enough to stimulate any big adaptations. So that's why on a time constrained training budget, spending a lot of time there isn't going to be very productive.
And that's too why you, with your friends, I mean, I've experienced the same thing. When you're going in a tempo, you can kind of talk a little bit. It feels good. The key to, like, Jonathan's kind of talked about this, but the key to being faster and beating other people is handling discomfort. Like, yes. You do workouts, and if you can do a workout, what you're really just feeling is discomfort. Like, you're there, and that's why if someone interrupts you during it, you're a little bit madder. But when you're riding, I mean, your body's going to make it, right? You're probably barely ever going to push it to the point where you're going to fall over. When you're doing those thresholds, you're just uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. You can handle uncomfort. And that's why
it's all about coping.
That's why endurance athletes, it's like a bigger mental game than weightlifters. Mm-hmm. You do something like CrossFit and there's longer CrossFit workouts. But if you lift the weights or do CrossFit, like, you're going to feel uncomfortable for 5 seconds to a minute, right? And it'll be a little more pain, but to me, that's totally easier to have than to do a 40K TT where I'm going to be like really, really uncomfortable for 20 minutes. And that last minute is going to hurt just as much as that entire workout minute. Right.
Yeah. So they're actually starting to show us that the amount of electrical activity that's going on in your brain, you know, how hard your brain's actually working is harder in something like a sustained 20 minute threshold effort or the end of a long ride where you're just hanging in there than studying for, say, a final exam.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. There's
this Zen moment that you might have experienced when you get into it. There's one where you get like really aware of your uncomfortableness, and then Chad's text, you'll come up on it and it'll be like, just drop your shoulders, get that look off your face.
Yep.
Get easier elbows that are a little bit weaker. Don't grab onto the handlebar so tight. And if you do that, you get like this Zen moment where like you're just kind of flowing. You're still hitting your power targets and you look back and you're like, 6 minutes just went by. I have 2 minutes left. I can do this for those 2 minutes. That's the mind state you need to be in. And it's something you always try to achieve. It happens in like all aspects of high level things. Piano playing, if you're a musician, if you're a pro athlete, if you're a writer, you know, writing a book, things just flow for a while, getting that Zen mind state. It's interesting.
All sorts of coping mechanisms, and I try to litter those throughout the workout text, but and there are plenty that I don't hit on. So the idea is to tolerate it. I mean, your body can do far more than you think it can, but the minute you start to talk yourself out of it or check out of it or your attention wanders, that's when everything starts to kind of work against you. So it's really so very psychological, and try to convey that and teach people that they can do this. You just have to make yourself do it.
You're not weak of mind. You can do it.
Yes. I always think of Trevor, our community manager, and how he just gracefully rides away from me every time we're climbing. And I look at how calm he is, and it just frustrates me like crazy. But when I'm in that moment, I just think, ride like that and just ride away from myself. So
yeah, and he's a pro mountain biker, so he's not just our community manager.
yeah, he's a beast. I wanted to talk on something before we get off of this question. There's like, so things tend to go, or I should say public opinion tends to move in these swings like a pendulum, right? And everyone was all about traditional base, that kind of low zone two tempo approach, and now there was that one video where GCN talked about the gray zone, and now everyone is like, the gray zone, they hate it. And to be honest, I think that we don't need to absolutely hate and avoid the tempo workouts, right, Chad? I mean, they have their place. And
absolutely.
You shouldn't be avoiding that power zone at all, Sean. It's just you should be doing it when you should be doing it, right? And then you should be in other power zones when you should be doing that too. Now, granted, on a group ride with a bunch of guys, you're not, I mean, unless you guys are very organized, you might not be riding at specific power zones at percentages of FTP. You just have to understand the type of adaptations that are coming around when you're riding in tempo, and understand the type of adaptations that come around when you're riding other zones.
Jonathan, though, in tempo, you don't really get we don't, I don't think we prescribe any tempo workouts in mm-hmm. any of the plans.
No,
it's
no.
either
and we don't, so right?
There's not really a great, besides, there's not really a great time of the year to do tempo rides. I mean, there's in a race where, of course, you're not going to be like, sorry, guys, I'm in endurance, so I'll see you later. Or I'm going to go too hard. Or you're in a group ride. But other than that, for optimal training, there is a...
Well, yeah,
argument
what we're focused on, what we're focused on is getting you faster in the most efficient amount of time, right? In the most efficient way possible. And the way we do that is through structured intensity that is higher than that. So, and then having you rest at specific intensities as well. So, yeah. So yes, but just the same, when you ride in the tempo or when you ride at tempo and you're riding with your friends, don't hate yourself for it. It's okay. You know, the gray zone isn't something that you should punish yourself for touching.
Exactly. It's not going to, you're not going to like fall off the bike, right?
Yeah, exactly. So, and then the follow-up question with this. This is a follow-up to if he should ride in gray zone at all or avoid it at all costs or not. If so, does the same hold true for the pace in a Century or Grand Fondo road ride or like an endurance mountain bike race? Should I try to stick to the endurance zone or jump it up to sweet spot? So in other words, if your race depicts a certain pace or your pace or your pacing plan has tempo in it, should you avoid it? I think we've kind of answered this question more or less, but
yeah, something like a Grand Fondo, you're basically going to ride that whole race in tempo anyways. I mean, maybe even more toward the endurance zone, but you should be so lucky to be able to hold your tempo pace for I don't know how long it takes you, but say 5 or 6 hours.
Well, Ironman triathlon too, you're probably going to be in that tempo zone mm-hmm. and you couldn't ride it all at sweet spot unless you're doing like a 4 hour bike split. Yeah. And even that will be extreme. I mean, there's only a couple people in the world that can do that. And for a lot of people, zone two will be too low. So yeah, if it's in your race, I mean, once you get to the race, it's not about getting more fit. It's about getting that race done so you can get as high a result as you possibly can. So ride it how you need to.
And Sean has one last question here. I know you've had similar questions like this before, but how do you suggest that I integrate... he's talking about other workouts, so I'll back up a little bit. He says he has a question on how to handle TSS for all three of his training plan or for his training phases, base build and specialty, as I do a lot of other things during the fall, winter, and spring outside of my races in the summer months. So he's talking about playing basketball 1 to 3 times per week. Once the winter hits, he snowboards at least 1 to 2 times per week. That sounds fun, 1 to 2 times per week. I know you've had similar questions like this before, but how do you suggest I integrate these other workouts into each of the three phases? Or in other words, does it vary? Chad, do you have any advice on that before we go any further into his question?
Yeah, I mean, you kind of want to track that stress. If it's something consistent and it could potentially affect your fitness, keeping tabs on it is a great idea. So if you want to credit yourself for that so that, you know, maybe you see I played basketball twice this week and snowboarded twice this week, that had an impact, or, you know, why did my training suffer? And you look back and you see, oh, wow, I did a whole lot of other stuff that week. So keeping track of it's fine. If you want to tie, a TSS equivalent to it, that's fine too. You're just going to have to kind of come up with that on your own. There's no real measured output there for us to base a TSS metric on, but keeping track of it is absolutely a good idea.
For me in general too, with those, like, so basketball isn't, compared to cycling, basketball is a very low cardio workout and it's not very muscular for me either. It's more like skill base and I get a little bit tired, but like snowboarding, I don't do that a lot, but I know our CTO, we're right by some mountains. If he skis or snowboards, his legs will be thrashed right the next day. So maybe do your cycling before your snowboarding rather than afterwards. And even the same day, you could totally in the morning do your cycling and then go snowboard or, you know, something like that.
Yeah. And one thing to keep in mind is Chad said, you can add up the TSS, but remember that, and you, cause you asked the question following this, Sean, you say, can I substitute workouts? In other words, just say, well, I had this workout and then I could, you know, but I'm going snowboarding today, so I'll just substitute it. Remember, you're doing something that's totally different than what you would be doing on the bike. You're not getting adaptations that you would be getting if you're snowboarding than you would if you were doing an over-under workout. You know,
yeah, you're looking at stress in a general sense, and our workouts are anything but general. They're all pretty, pretty specific. Exactly.
Yeah, just pay attention to how you feel too, right? Like if you're starting to feel super run down and be a little hard on yourself, don't be easy on yourself. Be like, oh, I'm a little tired. I'm going to skip a workout. But if you really get run down, then do it. But it's totally the same. Like don't think that, oh, I'm gonna work out 6 extra times a week, therefore my cycling's gonna improve. But if it's just basketball and snowboarding, your cycling's not gonna get, like, your friend who's good at basketball, have him do an FTP test and see where he's at. It's it's probably not going to be at 4 watts a kilo.
That could be fun too. We've done that with a few employees here at the office.
So I'll tell a story. We have an employee here named Rob, and I think his bench press is like 350 pounds or something like that.
He was like, born to bench press, and that's it. He's shaped like Mr. Incredible. He's like an upside down triangle. He's
a strong guy and always would tell us about how strong he is and stuff. And he
he owns the gym.
Sport agent, and not really, he's never really cycled before in his life. So we actually have a video on our Facebook page of him doing an FTP test, but he just left for Colorado to go, he graduated to start another job. But there's another guy here named Larry who mountain bikes, and Larry's probably 130 pounds. But so we saw Rob do an FTP test, and he tried to hit 300 watts and just got destroyed, right? Couldn't handle it. The rest of the workout probably did about 40 watts, barely pedaling. And that goes to show you, a guy like Larry, who's small but mountain bikes a lot, Larry's FTP is probably 250, I bet. And, you know, Rob probably got an FTP of 100. It just hits
118. 118 was his, FTP. Was his
exactly,
FTP.
One FTP. Yeah, yeah. And the guy, so he can bench press 350 pounds, but his FTP is 118.
And that just shows you. Coming in, he was like, what's a big FTP? And that's what he shot for. So these are all examples of what not to do. So we love Rob, by the way. All right. Lately, I am so frustrated at my current performance. This is from a guy named Razi here. Another question. I'm not a racer or triathlete. I'm just an average person that enjoys riding with a group on weekends. I'm new to cycling, and you've been at it since April of 2014. I commute to work every day on a hybrid type bike. So good for you. I got myself a road bike and joined the local cycling club. And then here's the question. You've been having trouble keeping up with the group and climbing hills and so on. I've done all the right things as far as nutrition, training indoors at home on the road, and everything else. You say you push yourself hard, but the legs won't go anymore at some point. You're 46 years old, 178 pounds, eat a very good, balanced, nutritious diet. I follow all the advices when I'm on the road, including what I put in my water bottles and what is in my back pocket jersey as far as nutrition goes. You're following all the lines. I'm totally at a loss here. I hope I'm making sense. So he needs some advice. It sounds like he's just feeling run down. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, maybe. I don't see any mention here of specific training. So my guess is that you're lacking intensity. Riding with a group is one thing, but when they accelerate and you can't go with them, that's just a question of fitness. And fitness comes with either a whole lot of miles or some intensity, or ideally a combination of both, but certainly favor the intensity. So if your training doesn't contain any intensity at the moment, then just pick a training plan. Sweet Spot Base is an excellent place to start. I'd be willing to bet you'll see improvements far and away, much higher than anything you've seen so far.
Yeah, you said you commute to work every day on a hybrid type bike. Normally when people commute, they're probably doing tempo, right? It feels good, you're going fast, but you're not really getting big adaptions. My opinion for someone who's racing is to save some time and not commute, and take that time that you save from the commuting and put it into an actual structured 1 hour workout on the trainer. There's other benefits too for commuting. You know, you don't have to pay for the car and you're doing better on the roads and gas and all that kind of stuff. So if you have time to do another workout, you can, but I would stop the commuting and just focus on doing a really structured workout if you want to keep up with these people. And this guy, he doesn't actually even say he's a train road user. So if you're not a train road user, what you're going to want to do is start doing interval training on the road. I would start with probably doing, like, find a hill about 10 minutes long and do a 10 minutes up almost as hard as you can, then a 5 minute rest. It's really hard without a power meter and train road and, you know, all this stuff to kind of give you general stuff, but just a basics. Start with two intervals that are 10 minutes long with 5 minutes rest, work it up to four, and try to go up them as hard as you can. That's the very loose, I have no power meter, no structure, better than commuting. Chad, what do you think about that?
Yeah, Rozzy, if your training doesn't at this point in time incorporate any sort of intensity, any structured intervals like that, or just something that's hard, really hard, and repeated, then that's where you start. If it does, then it could be a question of, you know, overreaching, just pushing yourself a little too far, a little too often.
He's a beginner too. So
yeah,
if you do something structured, you're going to get so much faster.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I can definitely attest to that. Two things that I wanted to bring up. Firstly, one of the things that helped me when I was new to cycling, because I'm relatively new to cycling too. I mean, I've been riding since 2013, really, the end of 2012, 2013. And I had that huge boost that you talked about, Nate, once I introduced structure, massive boost. But here's the interesting thing here. I was really cool when I started cycling, like really cool, right? In my mind. So when I was going out, every time I was riding the bike, I wasn't riding, I was training in my mind. That's what I told myself. And once I got on a structured training plan, I quit doing that. And I was honest with myself. Am I riding? And then I was honest with myself even more. Am I just screwing my training over? Because I got on a structured training plan that had structured work and structured rest. And if I followed that, I would not only be getting faster, but I would make sure that I was resting as well. And that's a key part. You can't get faster if you're not rested. And that's what a good training plan does, is it prescribes both.
You're at 4.8 watts per kilo and you've only been training for 2 years.
2.5, yeah. Yep.
What, you won a state championship and man, we need to do a blog post about you, man. I thought you'd been riding for like 10 years.
Nope. No. Dirt Jeez. Bikes prior to
yeah,
that.
Yeah, you were a dirt biker before that, but that's crazy, yep. Jonathan.
So that's just my two cents is, and this is just maybe describing what Nate and Chad have said already earlier. That's the beauty of a training plan. So many people think that it's going to prescribe the work I need. Yeah, but it prescribes the rest. And I can't stress the importance of following your rest intervals with the same diligence that you do your work intervals. It's just, it really does pay off, especially when you're talking about riding with a group. And when a group goes away from you, and then if, you know, you manage to hold on to them for the first attack, but you can't go on the second, that's a great example of if you're limiting or following your work or your rest intervals with precision, then you'll be able to attack again, you know, that type of a deal. So, all right, this is going to be the last question here, and it's from Matt. Matt says, hi, I'm relatively new to Trainer Road, and I've been dipping into in and out, I assume of Trainer Road to augment outdoor training, but I've acquired a new Wahoo kicker recently and really wanted to start getting the max benefit out of Trainer Road this year. That's a good step to do that. Electronic trainers are pretty cool there. Okay, so getting into the question, I'm carrying my best ever fitness levels into the winter, and whilst I am obviously worried about losing these, I assume your fitness levels, I understand that it would be better to hit traditional base again rather than straight into sweet spot base in order to make better gains down the road. So first of all, let's address that one. Is that necessarily a correct assumption, Chad?
Not necessarily. I mean, you can go about it both ways. If you're carrying a high level of fitness into this and perhaps a high level of fatigue, then maybe sweet spot base is a good fit for a little while. And if you've got the time to do traditional bases may be a better fit for a little while. If you got the time to do both, I suppose you could stack them end to end. But at this point, I honestly think you could probably use a little bit of a downturn in intensity. So maybe the traditional base for even a 4 week just a short endurance block might be a good way to go.
And what volume of traditional base do you recommend for that, Chad?
Bit about the fact that he says high is out of the question with his time commitments, and then he doesn't want to do low volume because he doesn't feel like he can get the adaptations that he needs. And if just doing Trainer Road, following low volume, and that's it, it's probably going to be pretty tough, especially since you're coming in with fitness.
With mid, what about sweet spot base mid volume? Because I think in general, what we usually recommend is for traditional base, if you can't go with high volume,
mm-hmm.
unless you have some type of injury problem or
you've already
older.
Got good fitness, you're going to need a lot of volume. So I think probably the mid volume sweet spot base is going to be maybe the better way to go.
And here's the one thing that I can suggest. Don't worry about losing your fitness levels. Clearly you're the type of person that's committed to following a training plan. You're already laying out your training for the next year. So you mentioned that you're worried about losing that. And certainly, you know, if you quit riding your bike for a month, you're probably going to lose something, right? But don't worry about losing your fitness levels. You know, Chad, what would you say to even a week off and then getting back into sweet spot base?
Yeah, or a couple weeks off. I mean, you could just ditch the structure for a while, ride for the enjoyment of it, and then jump back into something like sweet spot base mid volume. Typically, the sweet spot is going to fit 9 out of 10 riders. I mean, it's just a more intensive structured. It's actually more about intervals than the traditional base. Traditional base is more traditional, long, slow. And high volume, whereas sweet spot base is basically more bang for your buck.
Traditional bass too is boring. Sweet spot bass is very entertaining. It's just boring and
entertaining by requirement, right? It requires your focus.
Unless you can do the high volume, I strongly recommend that you look at the sweet spot. And even if you, the sweet spot high volume too is, it's going to be. I mean, if you have early races too, it's probably the superior path. We're changing the text on Trainer Road a little bit, and we're saying for traditional bass high volume, only do it. You know, if you can ride a lot. But also, if you're a grand tour rider, we're going to put you to traditional bass high volume. If you're not,
and mention Nate said grand tour rider, that doesn't mean that you ride grand fondos. This is grand tour. Yeah. That's a very different thing.
Just to show you that there are some people that need it, but it's a very select few that have kind of, you know, they're Cat 1, they can handle, you know, 800 TSS, they can do a lot of stuff.
They're almost at their peak already.
Yeah, their peak fitness, like physiologically. They might be doing these really big stage races. There are people like that, so that's why we have it. But most likely, that's not you. And if it is you, you know it, right?
Yeah, those guys are fighting over a 1% gain. You know what I mean? From this year to the next year, because that's the difference between, you know, finishing way back in the pack or finishing at the front. And to be honest, most of us that have the type of time constraints that come with a job, a family, and everything else outside of just riding bikes, we're far away from just, you know, fighting for that extra 1%. We might be at, you know, 99% of our current potential with our time constraints, but not our physiological potential, perhaps. It's pretty tough to get to when you have all the constraints of a normal job and all that. So, yeah.
Chad, did you have anything else to say with that? I saw you shaking your head a little bit.
No, I agree.
Shaking it in a positive
way. I think we've covered that pretty well.
Cool. All right, guys. Well, thanks for sticking with us. Once again, you can find this podcast on iTunes, on Stitcher, on SoundCloud, and on all the different podcasting apps you may use. Just search for Ask a Cycling Coach or Trainer Road, and you'll find it on there. You can submit questions to get answered on the podcast. For the chance to get answered, I should say, we try to get to all of them. And you can do so at support@trainerroad.com, and they'll give you the link to enter the questions. Thanks again, guys, and happy training.
Thanks, everybody.
Bye-bye.